Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are ready to start at the beginning of paper 43, which is old single column, page 485. All right, not only are we starting new paper, but we're starting a new block of papers. Remember how, as we started part two, first you had the block on the local universes themselves, and you know, and specifically the local universe headquarters level. And then we had the two blocks about universes of beings and universes of things. And we just finished those two papers, 41 and 42, on universes of things. Now we're ready to get back in into the hierarchy of the local universe and continue our journey down from the local universe headquarters level into the constellations. So just as the title of this first paper says, I'm going to take a look at the constellation level in greater detail. I think there's probably really nothing we need to say too much up front, other than, you know, it's definitely going to be a distinct shifting of the gears from where we've been here, and with a lot of intense physics as we've been going through, physics and astronomy as we've been going through the previous two papers. But there's, even though we're not going to be looking so much immediately for science, you know, we do want to always be looking for what goes beyond the immediate. And you'll see there's something there trying to get you to reflect on right in the very first sentence that, you perhaps have not totally recognized yet. So we'll get into some fun stuff just right away in the first sentence. Let's get into it here.
Paper 43, The Constellations. Urantia is commonly referred to as 606 of Satania in Norlashadech of Nebadon, meaning the 606th inhabited world in the local system of Satania, situated in the constellation of Norlashadech, one of the 100 constellations of the local universe of Nebadon. Constellations being the primary divisions of a local universe, their rulers link the local systems of inhabited worlds to the central administration of the local universe on Salvington, and by reflectivity to the super administration of the Ancients of Days on Uversa.
Okay. You notice they put a large paragraph break after that first paragraph, just setting that first one off, wanting you to get your bearings to begin with, and you know, very obvious the way they're just literally giving you geography, that they want you to get your bearings. Just one point up front. Why did the Revelators decide to call these primary divisions of a local universe constellations? Why did they take our designation constellation and give it this new meaning? The primary reason is very straightforward. If you go out in the night sky, and scan from horizon to horizon, surveying the celestial sphere, as it were, above, basically all the stars that you can see with the naked eye, setting aside being able to see the Milky Way, you obviously can't see the individual stars of the Milky Way with your naked eye, but setting the Milky Way aside, basically all those individual stars that you see in every direction, all the way around the Earth, are in the local universe. That distance that you can expect to see a star with the naked eye is basically penetrating no deeper than the size of a local universe. So, that idea then, if you're basically looking at the local universe around you and you want to think about breaking that up, just like we do with that night sky and that celestial sphere, where we say that the stars that are in this direction in that celestial panorama are in such and so constellation, you know, Ursa Major, you know, or you know whatever it might be, Scorpius, or you know, whatever constellation. The way we break up all of those stars into those subunits, you know, that's roughly the same sort of divisioning that we're talking about here. Like they reminded you, there's 100 constellations in the local universe. So, you know, remember they're told that if there is a term that we have that can be, you know, appropriately used without too much confusion, rather than coining some, you know, new name for these divisions, because obviously no one is speaking English in the heavens. I mean, they've got to come up with English names for everything. You know, so that's why they picked it. You know, because it's just that basic dividing of all of the stars we see in the night sky, you know, into constellations. And so they do the same thing. They break the local universe up into the 100 constellations. All right, and then, like I said, that first sentence is really important. To come back around to the very, you know, beginning of the foreword, you know, and what we call this book we have in our laps, and we call it the Urantia Book. The Revelators, you know, call the Revelation the Urantia Papers. You know, this word, Urantia, how are we supposed to think about that? You know, again, it's an English word. You know, they don't speak English in the heavens. They're speaking local universe tongue, super universe tongue, you know, one of the two. You know, languages that we can't even really imagine. You know, they're nothing like our human linear sorts of languages. You know, so it's not like they've taken some name and, you know, translated it, transliterated it, you know, or anything like that into an English name. You know, so how do we think about that? Well, notice that the first thing they're wanting to, you know, really get you to appreciate, you know, Urantia is commonly referred to as 606 of Satania, of Narlashadec, of Nebadon. Okay, you know, let that sink in. Oh, in other words, all of the inhabited worlds, they don't really have names for them like we name all the planets by, you know, Roman gods and, you know, and this sort of thing. Okay, they refer to them numerically. You know, it's 606 of Satania. So, you know, you're not even really sure, based on that, whether or not they use any sort of a name for the planet at all. You know, but they definitely gave us a name. Now, what did they give us? You know, you've got a word that has a stem and a suffix. U-R-A-N, you know, is the stem, and T-I-A is a suffix. You know, and that's an English word that's built in the way we build English words, coming from a Latin context. U-R-A-N is a Latin stem. It's a Latin stem that we use in the English language. You can look it up in the dictionary and see what that stem means in Latin. It means heavenly. And you go, well, okay, what about the suffix? And you try to look up that suffix, and you'll discover that suffix is not in the English language. We have the IA suffix that we brought over from Latin. But we don't have a TIA suffix, and neither did the Latins. The Revelators have coined that suffix. They've done it in the same way that we took the ION suffix and coined the TION suffix. You know, so we'd have two different noun-forming suffixes. The relatives are doing the same thing. That T comes from the past participle constructs in Latin. It's used as a little connecting element to to modify that a suffix. And so they're saying, okay, you've got the IA suffix. We'd like a parallel noun-forming suffix, TIA. And well, what's the idea? Well, that stem, U-R-A-N, one of the ways it's used is with the IA suffix, U-R-A-N-I-A, Urania. That as a proper noun, that's the muse of astronomy in Greek mythology. And if you just look that up, it's like, well, how do they think of that word literally? Why did they name the muse of astronomy Urania? Because they wanted to name her literally the heavenly one. Okay? The heavenly one. The one of the heavens. Okay? You know? So, Uran is heavenly in the sense of, of the heavens. So more literally, of that celestial domain, right, than some sort of a quality-like sense of heavenly, right? This the symphony is heavenly, or something like that. Okay? So, it's pretty obvious what they've done in coining this suffix. It's like, okay, you already have Urania, you have the heavenly one. They want a suffix that is not personal. They want an impersonal suffix in parallel to that personal one. So they coined the TIA. So you're going, so literally it's the heavenly place, or the place in the heavens. You're going, the heavenly place? Isn't that a little extreme? If it was a lowercase u, it would just be heavenly place, but I'm capitalizing a proper noun. So what am I meaning by that proper noun? In this case, I don't want it to be, just simply the definite article, the. But the idea is, if they're speaking to us, your heavenly place. Or if we're talking about it ourselves, it's our heavenly place, our place in the heavens. And of course, in the context of the revelation, by heavens, what do you mean? Our place in the cosmos. Right? The book is a revelation of truth. They want to reveal the truth of where we are. We don't have any direct sense of the truth of where we are, the way we talk about where we are. We say we live on Earth. Or the earth, be more proper, lowercase e, it's not really a proper noun. We just say we live on the earth. We live on the dirt. It's a very factual statement. There's no truth flowing through that thought. And you're saying, well, let's do that. The first thing we're going to do at the beginning of the foreword is we're going to give you a name that you can think about where you are that isn't so merely factual. Yes, you are on a ball of matter, but in truth, you're in a very definitive place in the cosmic system. You have a place in the cosmos. Every inhabited world is Urantia. If I'm a revelator and I'm walking up to a mortal on any world, I would say, this is your heavenly place. This is your place in the heavens. They do that a lot with the names that they've coined. They aren't specific to, say, the world or the local universe, you know, or the major sector. I mean, they're names that generally just describe that level in the hierarchy. The first upland in the nebula, you know, that's Nebadon. Right? I mean, that obviously is, you know, in the literal meaning of Nebadon, that word they've coined, is not somehow differentiating our local universe from some other local universe. It's a word that describes the local universe level, the truth of that level in the picture. And that's very much true with Urantia. It's a word to constantly remind you that you have a place in the cosmos, that there's a truth to to where you are, no matter how lowly or benighted, if you're aware of the rebellion and the default, this planet may seem. You know, nonetheless, it's a place in the cosmos. You know, and not only that, you know, remember, they tell you that every world is administered, you know, cared for, as if it was the heavenly place. You know, it isn't literally the, but it's cared for as if it was the only planet in the entire universe of universes. So there is even a little measure of truth to just letting the definite article be what you mean by capitalizing the U and making it a proper noun. Okay. But, basically, it just means your or our heavenly place. And it's, you know, it's, and you don't want to think of it, like they're pointing out in that first sentence, that really on high they talk about planets with some proper name like Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, okay? They refer to it as, 138 of Satania and 606 of Satania and 1 of Satania and, you know, et cetera.
Did they use Satania?
You see, and again, of course, the beginning is, everything, every other word is the same way. I mean, they don't use Latin or Hebrew or Greek or anything when they talk in the heavens. You know, so all these words, these English words, are for the, merely for the purposes of the revelation. You know, let's just take a second, So why did they call the local system Satania?
Yeah, I often wonder that, because especially 606, people look at her,
yeah.
Something wrong with this.
Yeah, well, they don't want to read the actual registry number, which actually ends in 666, right? The first thing to note, and this is important to appreciate where you are when you're down at the constellation level, they're purposely wanting you to recognize a parallel in the big picture hierarchy to what goes on with developing culture and civilization on a single inhabited world. You know, the first group beyond the family unit that you have is the clan. And then clans collect together into tribes. And then tribes collect together into nations. And then eventually nations evolve into genuine territorial states. Clan, tribe, nation, territorial state, now that sequence. And when you get to a territorial state, the contrast from a nation, it may be a territorial state composed of a single nation of people, but why are you calling it a territorial state in distinction? What's the evolutionary step up that you've taken? It's now not just a group of people with their mores, it's a state with laws. It's a group of people that have chosen to be governed by laws. Okay, that sequence, they want you to recognize, is in the bigger picture. You start on an inhabited world. In the big picture, the quote-unquote clans, that consanguineous sets, are the races, basically the sangic races. right? Those are the clans in the big picture. And then the peoples of a whole inhabited world, that's the tribe. Okay? So the next notch up, the local system level, is parallel to the nation level. And so when they coin names for local systems, they end them with the IA suffix because besides it being used, you know, especially in the Arantia book, as a personal one suffix to distinguish from an impersonal, you know, like place, TIA, one, IA, like we just talked about, it also is the suffix that indicates a nation, like India. I mean, technically, India doesn't name a territorial state, first and foremost. It names a people. It literally means the people of the Indus Valley region. Okay, it's really talking about a people, a nation of people. Nation is fundamentally people still first, land second. You know, just like tribes are people first, you know, land second. Okay, and so Satania, it has an IA suffix because it's the nation of something or other. You know, and the other local systems, you know, if you look them up, they all end in IA. Okay, they're the nation of something or other. Then the trick is to figure out what the root or the stem is indicating. You know, the word Satan, lowercase s, is the Hebrew word meaning adversary. You know, which we, you know, personified into, capitalized it. You know, the Satan, the capital A adversary. You know, so they're playing off of that. This local system had a rebellion. There's adversity now in this local system because of that rebellion. This is the nation of adversity. Right? That's what it literally means. Satania literally means the nation of adversity.
They could have called it adversity, maybe.
and they you can probably bet that on the side, rather than, you know, doing something like that, you know, you're actually using the word adverse, you know, in some way directly. You know, it's like Jesus' parables. For those that want an easy way to dismiss this book and, you know, as the work of Satan, you know, how much more proof do you need? Then it's got Satania all over in it, you know. Right. Those people are not ready for the fifth epical revelation. They haven't even made it to the fourth epical revelation yet. Okay? They're still needing the third, right? So, you know, it's best that they just have an easy out. You know, like Jesus always provided those listeners that weren't ready to, you know, they didn't have ears to hear. Okay. But for those who know this is a revelation of truth and not the work of the iniquitous one, any of the iniquitous ones, it's the nation of adversity. That's the truth of where you live. No escaping that truth. It's a truth we all perforce must live, because of choices that were made by our superiors. So you're going, you have the races, the clans, the world, the tribe, the local systems, the nations. The next notch up is going to be the territorial state, the domain of law. Right, when you get up to the constellation level, the constellations are the legislative level. That's where the laws are made. So the pattern fits very perfectly. Clans are consanguineous. Sangix, I mean, you know, the name even Sangix, you know, it literally, you know, means bloodlines. Right? So, you know, sang, blood. Yep.
Doesn't it say somewhere in the first part we talked about the Father that the Father is the only being who really knows the name and number of every planet, or do they not say name? So does every planet have a name?
Right. Well, see, that's what, you know, that's what I'm kind of pointing out. We don't really know. I mean, you know, you can, you know, it seems like maybe they do, but they say that the planets are commonly referred by their numbers.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe in some circles they have names. I mean, they just don't really explain. You know, but anyway.
They did mention a planet that started with the name...
Well, there's Panoptia. See, again. Right. See, and that's just, again, and they're just coining another name again. I mean, and, you know, I don't want to go into it, but I just made a copy so I could remind you. You know, I mean, a lot of the main words in the Urantia book, I've figured out the etymology. You know, if you go into the library in Perfecting Horizons, you can get the copy of this etymology, you know, and look up names like Panoptia. And, you know, and figure out what that name literally means, you know, as an English coined name. You know, and when you're coining English words, you're mainly drawing from Latin and Northern European. There'll be a little bit of Greek thrown in occasionally. You know, the Revelators coined them in that same way. It's predominantly Latin and Northern European. They throw in a little bit of Greek every once in a while. So they coined the names as if they evolved, you know, in the normal evolutionary process into an English word, because they were told they had to write this book in English. So they have to coin words in English as if they are words that evolved through the process into an English word. It's all very, you know, definitive that way. So, you know, when you look at Nirlashadek, that one, if you drop the deck part, you know, you see you have a TIA suffix there. You've got a place. You know, it's the such and so place again, just like Urantia, Nirlasha. Now we'll read in a little bit why they stuck. You know, they've sort of fudged with Hebrew a little bit and are pretending that Hebrew has an Englishized suffix D-E-K, and they're using that, so they're tacking on this suffix of dek to indicate that this place has identification with the Melchizedeks, and we'll read in the next section what that is. But that little special qualification aside, it's the name of this constellation is Nirlashadek. Well, why? Well, the L-A, that's just another old spelling of L-A-W. That's law, right? That's where we're at. We're at the constellation level. You know, and again, in Northern European, N-O-R is north. It's the word north. All right, so it's the northern law place. Okay. The only place that they give you a little clue about where in the local universe of Nebadon our constellation is in its name. This constellation is in the northern regions of the local universe. You know, every constellation is a law place, and this is one of the ones that's in the northern regions of the local universe. It's the northern law place. I mean, who knows? Maybe, you know, it's the most northerly, or, you know, I mean, we don't know. But, I mean, but it give you that little clue about where it is, you know, relative to the super universes going around in the super universe level. It's, you know, in the northerly direction. Yep. Here, just over here first.
Well, I'm trying to put north into context, because if it's the local universe, I mean, if it's revolving around the center of the local universe.
Again, right now it's northerly. Yeah, I mean, it won't be northerly sometime in the future and stuff. See, again, all these names are relative. They're coined just for the sake of the revelation. There's no one in the universe of universes that's calling this place the Northern Law Place. That's illogical for celestials, like you're just pointing out, you know, because local universes go around and around galaxies, and, you know, galaxies going around and around the central universe. It's all coined for our benefit relative to our immediate recognition.
What's most remarkable, though, is that a system has to stay localized within the
mm-hmm.
constellation.
Yep.
The constellation somehow has to stay localized.
Right.
So this can't just be laws of linear gravity holding this together and keeping it together.
Right. So for those of you on the webinar, he's bringing up this issue. How does all this hang together? I mean, the local universe has to stay together, constellations have to stay together, local systems have to stay together. Well, we remember back when we were talking about local universes, I mean, it's very definitive there in a very precise way. The master physical controllers, the power beings, I should say in general, not just the master physical controllers, but the power beings keep the collection of matter that is a local universe together. So as that local universe swings round and around, you know, the center of the galaxy, it doesn't diffuse out. And probably, you know, thought about the analogy of taking, you know, a glass of milk and putting a little drop of chocolate on the surface, you know, and gently stirring it and watching that little drop of chocolate get stretched out into a, you know, a thin thread, you know, until, you know, a couple of times around, and the chocolate is spread out over the whole surface of the, you know, the glass of milk. I mean, that's what would happen to a local universe, you know, 2-3 times around, and the stars of a local universe would be everywhere in the Milky Way galaxy, okay? Because there's differential rotation in the Milky Way galaxy. So they have to hold it together very definitively. And then inside of that, there's probably a little bit of slop to this on the inside. They, you know, when you have inhabited worlds, okay, obviously they're going to, in order, before they set them up as inhabited worlds, they're going to make sure that they have the dark gravity body control and whatnot in place so that those inhabited worlds stay with that local system headquarters. But, you know, some of the stars that are currently in Satania, you know, there's no reason to believe that they have to stay that way. You know, they could go off into some other local system. You know, I mean, remember, some of these stars, you know, just are allowed to follow the natural course and cease to exist at some point. You know, so, but once things are, you know, they're not going to have a local system drift over into another constellation, right? Once that local system is actually established. But remember, the last local system headquarters was finished in Nebadon just 5 billion years ago. Okay, so before that, you know, you could have had local system-like regions that weren't actually, established, at least in a beginning fashion, you know, just sort of being wherever until they brought things into control. You know that in this constellation, you know, they tell you, things are still a little bit wild west, a little bit wild and woolly here in this constellation. There's a lot of energy, a lot of matter in Nirlashadek that's not brought into any sort of masterly control yet, right? So, you know, it would be allowed, you know, if that's what's best, you know, let it go over there into that system or over into that constellation, whatever keeps things at best in balance. They would allow things to drift about. The only thing that's really locked down is the local universe. You know, you're not letting, remember, because that's a very precise thing. So they're not letting, you know, the matter of one local universe mix over with another one and stuff like that.
Where do you find that information that Nebadon headquarters was established 6 billion years ago?
5 billion years ago is when the last local system was built. I mean, Nebadon was started a long time ago. But up at the beginning of part three, let's see if I can flip to that really quick.
You can tell me.
I can probably find it really quick here. So it's in section 3 of paper 57, right before the 300 billion years ago paragraph. They say the local system headquarters planets were constructed over a period extending from, you know, way back when they began things 300 billion years ago, from that time to about 5 billion years ago. Yeah, that's where they tell you that. See, so that was, they got all of the constellation and the local universe stuff built right away. That was all done in very short order. But the local systems, that's a long process of slowly. It's like, well, let's get this region kind of calmed down. And when it's settled enough, they build a local system headquarters, you know, and then they go to the next one and the next one. And, you know, so over billions and billions of years, they slowly got all of those local systems roughed out enough that they could build the architectural worlds and not have them, you know, end up being at the epicenter of a supernova one day or something, you know. right? I mean, they've got to get things calmed down and organized enough that, you know, they can build something that's going to be eternal. Right?
So the paper was 37?
No, 57, the first paper of part 3. 57, section 3. Right before it says 300 billion years ago, they have that statement. all right, it's very important to, you know, to not have this misimpression about the proper names of place names in the Urantia book. You know, have this mixed up in your heads. I mean, they're coined names, or selected names for the purposes of the revelation, just to convey truth. Remember, the purpose of revelation is not to reveal fact, it's to reveal truth. Giving you some sequence of Latin letters that vaguely sounds like what the local universe tongue would be, that's pointless, right? They're not trying to give you something factual like that. They want to give you something that's truthful about the constellation, the local system, right, et cetera.
So when we get to the mansion worlds and beyond, and you know, people want to know where we're from, is it going to be more likely that we're from 606?
Most likely, that's what you'll say.
Are we from the planet where Jesus did, or Michael did?
I mean, you know, you might say you're from the world of the cross, but eventually, you know, you'll get to someone that go, what? you know, is that significant? Right. Yeah. You know, remember how they do at the end of that one? You know, they give you the numbers of all the different things. You know, every constellation has a number. Every local system has a number.
And numbers will be different for us, just like they are for angels. They consciousize one number. It's not like a string of digits is to us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. All of this will be very different as we think about it more, relate to it more non-linearly. Right. You know, it won't be so you know, linear, sequential. You know, like those numbers. They will be. You know, and you will, when you get into the big picture perspective, these numbers won't be just numbers. They will embody the pattern. The precision of the pattern that's being expressed, right? I mean, you won't think of them as just a number. You know, it'll mean something that it's 606 and not 607. That's telling you something about the flower that's unfolding, right? There's something very profound about this. Nothing is random, right? And you'll begin to relate to that precision in a mathematical way. I mean, just a little bit above us, angels are very mathematically minded, right? So, you know, when we just get a little bit better mind, we're all going to be naturally much more mathematically minded. And
so we're 606ers are over here in the handicap section. Good spot for us.
No, you're Agendotters. They'll be, you know, looking to you for enlightenment.
Maybe you.
No, they'll be looking to you for enlightenment. no pressure.
No pressure.
So, now is as good a time as any to kind of take it up a notch. Because one day, yes. And they're going to be gathered around you, and they'll say, tell us a story about 606, Uncle Joshua, you know, and you're going to have to be able to say something cosmically significant.
I thought we were handicapped.
Okay, so, you know, so that gives you, you know, a little sense, and like I said, you know, if you want to get into like more of the details, just get the, you know, pull out the etymology again and remind yourself of, you know what uversa means, what splendid means, you know, etc. What all those designations mean. Now each of them is a little pithy reminder of kind of a core essence of truth about that level, right? It's just a simple little thumbnail reminder of the truth of the hierarchy. Yeah, it's seldom is just giving you some factual thing about the hierarchy. That's just not the point. It's a revelation of truth.
Paradise is not
to
die. Not a paradise.
No. Yes. Pardon the pun. Okay. Okay, so what else do we have in there? Let's see. You know, like Salvington, you know, remind yourself of what Salvington, you know, means. And I mean, maybe just before we end there, you know, that last little bit about, so obviously the constellation is linking the local universe headquarters to the local system level, like they're saying there. It's the connecting link. Remember, it's also the link out. The Most Highs are very tightly tied to the Ancients of Days, right? And that's not just a you know, a little footnote thing. That's one of the most significant things to remember when you're thinking about Veranda Dex. Don't ever forget their tight linkage to the Ancients of Days, because many times you won't understand some statement they make about the Veranda Dex or the Most Highs if you forget that. So it's why it's one of the things that they remind you of in this very first paragraph. Very key that, you know, they're like the deputies of the Ancients of Days, the Most Highs. The Veranda Dex, the very father-like expressions, right, of local universe descending sons. They're the very father-like ones, and the Ancients of Days are the super fathers, right? So,
And they have the faithful of days, too, on the
console.
Is that right, the
faithful? Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll get to the faithful of days here in a little bit, yeah. And why they're called faithfuls. And all right, so you have this linkage to the capital J judges, the Ancients of Days. You know, and where are they? They're on Uversa, you know. Well, Versa is Latin for hub, and why the letter U glued to it? There's the numbers again, right? You know, it's the 21st letter of the alphabet. You know, they think about those seven super universe capitals numerically. You have seven expressions of that threefold pattern. Right? We're the seventh expression of that threefold pattern. We're seven times three. We're 21. The 21st letter of the alphabet's U. That's why it's Uversa. Right? So just like 606, you know, they very much use numbers. That's why they tell you, you know, 1, 2, 3, the first, and things like that. I mean, numbers are very key because they're thinking about the truth that's in the patterns, and the numbers express that truth of the patterns. Okay, you know, what's the truth of the next planet out in our solar system, if you call it Mars? Well, the ancients, you know, thought that was expressing the truth because that was red and it was obviously about war, right? And the god of war, right? See, I mean, they were kind of, you know, we do this too, you know. It's not just some random sequence of letters that's pronounceable. You know, we picked something that we thought spoke to the truth of that very red sometimes, you know, planet that was moving around in the sky, you know, to ancient eyes. It looked like blood, right? Dripping with blood. So it must be the god of war. Right. So in a little less anthropomorphic way, you know, the celestial beings are doing the same thing. They're looking at the truth of the cosmos. You know, it's not just a universe. That's a factual statement. It's a cosmos. That's a truthful statement. You know, and it's a twofold truth. Intensively, a cosmos means universal harmony. Extensively, it means harmonizing universe. There's great truth in that word cosmos. You have a place in a great truth. You have a place in a cosmos. You don't just have a mere fact that you stand on a ball of dirt. You stand on the earth, you know, with the sun in the sky and the moon in the sky. No capital letters on any of those things, right? Okay, so So you can see just that first little paragraph. I mean, they want you, they put a big paragraph break there because they wanted you to, you know, spend some time reflecting on what they're saying. You know, don't get this notion that you're going to go to Melchizedek University and they're going to teach a class about Urantia. You know, that name is not in their textbooks. Okay, it's commonly referred to by 606. So that Urantia is for our sake. And it's not only that truth of, that you have a place in the heavens, but to see yourself in that bigger context. Every mortal on every inhabited world has a similar place in the heavens, a place in the cosmos. Everyone's from Urantia. If you want to challenge your mind to greater recognition of unity, don't limit the word Urantia to this ball of dirt. You know, think bigger than that. The truth is bigger than that. Everyone's from Urantia. Everyone has a place in the heavens. All right, let's get some more here.
The government of your constellation is situated in a cluster of 771 architectural spheres, the centermost and largest of which is Edentia, the seat of the administration of the Constellation Fathers, the most highs of Norlashadech. Edentia itself is approximately 100 times as large as your world. The 70 major spheres surrounding Edentia are about 10 times the size of Urantia. While the 10 satellites, which revolve around each of these 70 worlds, are about the size of Urantia. These 771 architectural spheres are quite comparable in size to those of other constellations.
Just the qualifier of that, and it's like, huh, so they aren't all exactly the same size. There's some variation. You know, why? You know, who knows? But for some reason, they're all roughly the same size. And what is that roughly the same size? You know, let's remind ourselves again. We've brought this up a few times over the recent months. So 100 times the size of the Earth makes it roughly how big? How big is both Edentia and Gerasim is the same way?
800,000 miles diameter.
Yeah, well, what object in the sky is roughly 100 times the diameter of the Earth?
The sun.
The sun, right? The central worlds and these architectural worlds are roughly the size of the sun. Big balls, okay? Very big spheres. 10 times, you know, so the primary satellites, 10 times the diameter of the Earth. That's roughly the size of Jupiter. Again, big, right? I mean, what's the surface area of something that has 10 times the diameter? How many times greater is the surface area of one of those primary satellites? 100 times greater surface area. You know, and there's no oceans, you know. So imagine how much surface area the Earth would have if there were no oceans, and then multiply that by 100, right? And you've got one of those primary satellites. A lot of territory for beings to be stomping around. You know, you initially think, well, shouldn't they be really huge? It's like, well, no. 100 times bigger in diameter, that's a pretty huge thing to begin with, okay? 100 times 100, it's getting to be a very large surface area, right? Remember that, you actually have structures on Gerasim and, well, here too, on Edentia, that are the size of the Earth, right? You know, it's like, well, let's build a little stadium. It can be about the size of the Earth, and that'll be about big enough. All right? They have plenty of room to have a structure that's the size of the planet. You know, when you're talking about surface area, that's that great. 10,000 times the surface area is a lot of room. Okay, so... Now, the thing that always jumps out at you when you're reminded about how many worlds there are at the constellation, 771 worlds. You've got the 70 primaries, and each primary has 10 secondary satellites. So you have 700 secondary satellites, 70 primaries, and it's just literally a string of pearls, 70, in a string of pearls around Edentia, in our case, and then a string of pearls of 10 around each of those primary satellites. Okay, and, you remember how this works with your Maurantia bodies. Remember how you have 570 different Maurantia bodies between here and leaving the local universe? But it's only 570, and there's 771 here. So remember, you don't get a separate Maurantia body for each of those sub-satellites. Okay, just for each of the primary satellites, so that the 10 sub-satellites go with the set, and then one for Edentia itself. It's not the super universe headquarters that you get a separate Maurantia body for every single world, all 491.
Super.
No, the local universe. It's your Maurantia just in the local universe. Remember, yeah. So at the local universe headquarters level, you have 491 different bodies there, one for each subsatellite, one for each satellite, and one for Salvington itself. So most of those 570 are there. But 71 of them are here, and then 8 are at the local system level. You have one for each of the mansion worlds, and then a separate Maurantia body for Gerasim. Okay. So even though this is a bigger number than the 491, so you don't relate to it with as much specificity as you do. See, so the complexity of what you're doing increases as you go up. You start with just 8, then you have 71, and then you have 491. Okay, so we don't have to relate to all of this 771-fold complexity, at a full level. But obviously, there must be a lot of reason why there is all that complexity, even if we don't have to literally embody all of that complexity, literally, as a different Maurantia body.
So, whereas our body today, starts out as a babe and grows to an old person, and if you really look at it, there's a lot of change that goes on inside your body. Whereas in this particular case, that's probably not necessarily, they don't necessarily evolve each one.
Well, they don't, the bodies don't quote-unquote age, of course.
Yeah.
But they do morph. I mean, they reflect your growth, right? And you outgrow them. You have to get a new body because literally you need to be able to manifest a higher cosmic character, and you can't do it in such a lowly body.
So they evolve.
So the bodies evolve. Right. Right. I mean, that would be the best way to think about it. You are growing as an individual. That Maurantia energy system that is your body is evolving parallel to your growth. Okay, I mean the evolution, evolution in general in the grand universe is a reflection of the growth of the body of the Supreme Being. Growth and evolution are just two ways of looking at the same thing. Let's see, am I anything else in there? They don't mention it right here, but remember, even if they are 100 times bigger in diameter, they have roughly the same gravity. Because we're a world that's sort of in the middle in terms of the gravity range, and so the architectural worlds are roughly like us, because they're made to be in the middle so that they're best suited for the spectrum. So the architectural worlds gravitationally will be very familiar to you, whether they're 100 times bigger or the same size as this planet. They're roughly the same gravity, and so obviously there's a lot of artificialness to having something that's 100 times bigger in diameter having the same gravity. You know, whether or not that's just the anti-gravity presence of the power beings, or it's that in part and part construct, you know, they don't explain. But they point out the obvious, that logically they would make the architectural worlds in the middle of the range of gravity, so that high gravity beings aren't too, you know, out of whack, and low gravity beings aren't too out of whack, you know, with the architectural worlds. All right, let's keep going here.
Edentia time reckoning and distance measurement are those of Salvington. And like the spheres of the universe capital, the constellation headquarters worlds are fully supplied with all orders of celestial intelligences. In general, these personalities are not very different from those described in connection with the universe administration.
Okay, so that little note, he's saying, so they're not going to have a whole, you know, another set of papers like we had the universes of beings. They're not going to have the constellations of beings. It's the same set of beings. So, you know, they're just referring you back to all those papers for the beings. For if people are like, where is it in the book that they tell you about the time reckoning? So if the time reckoning at the constellation level is the same as the local universe, that's paper 33, section 6, for those of you who, you know, if you're listening to the recording and you want to go look it up, that's where they have that little statement about how long the day is, how long Salvington's day is, and how long it takes Salvington to rotate once on its axis. A day is just like we think of it, what a day is. And then remember, years are 100 of whatever the day is. They use the decimal system. And does anyone remember, so then what it ends up being, that standard year compared to our year? Does anyone remember what that...
Eight.
No, you're thinking, that's super universe. It's five, yeah. It's about five Urantia years. And so, you know, the fact that I just reminded you of there, that bit about the day defines this, it's like, well, apparently they must make it so that Edentia, you know, the constellation headquarters worlds, have the same orbital or rotational period that Salvington does. I mean, you know, if they're using the same year, you know, same. I mean, it would be really weird if it wasn't. I mean, because they definitely use the axial revolution of a world to define a day. So, I mean, apparently between the lines, constellation headquarters worlds are made to have the same rotational period, you know, that the local universe.
Are they the same size?
We don't know how big Salvington is. Yeah, so we don't know about that issue. Right, so the speed would be different if the size was different. Yeah, right. Yeah. And then the other thing that they're kind of putting between the lines here and getting you to, wanting you to reflect on, when they say the distance measurement is the same as those on Salvington, you're going, well, gee, I don't remember them saying anything about distance measurement was back there when they were talking about time measurement with the local universes. The place they talk about distance measurement is up at the beginning of paper 46, when they're talking about the local systems. Now, right there in the beginning of section 1 in paper 46, they talk about the standard mile of Gerasim and the standard weight. Okay, yeah, and they talk about how the time, you know, is different for the local system than for the constellation and the local universe capital. The time is different. But see, they don't say anything about, you know, the weight or, you know, the distance being different. You know, so, but you think about it. I mean, they describe that the weight is based upon the automaton, which is the same everywhere, you know. And you notice they even called it the standard mile and the standard weight. Logically, I'm pretty sure that they're using the same weight and distance, you know, everywhere, because those are based on a universal fact of some sort. you know, some, you know, the radius of the automaton, the amount of inward motion of the automaton. I mean, they're, you know, they're basing it upon universal physical facts. But the time, you know, is a local thing. It's based upon, you know, the rotation of the world. Okay, so I think this distance measurement that they're referring to here is the one they explain up there, which is about 7 of our miles. The quote-unquote standard mile is about 7 of our miles. You know, and just notice what they're doing there. You know, it's like with day and, they're doing with mile. I mean, we have a length we call a mile. You know, we have a unit of distance that's appropriate for, you know, like telling you the speed of your car or how far it is to the next town. You know, we don't use inches for that. That would, you know, that's way too small. We don't use light years for that. That'd be way too big, right? You know, we pick a unit that's kind of handy for basically local separation description.
A lot of the world use kilometers. But...
Right, and a kilometer, you know, it's just the same thing. You know, it's a mile like, right? Yeah, but again, they're, you know, they were told to do it in English, and right, okay, right? You know, but you know, just remember that. I mean, no one on high. You know, you're not going to see a speed limit sign that has MI, you know, right. I mean, they're not using English on high. They don't literally have things called miles. But they have, you know, lengths that are equivalent to that. You know, bigger than a foot, you know, smaller than a light year. Right. That sort of size distance unit. You know, they have days, they have weeks, and they have years. You know, they just use a decimal. They take 10 of whatever the day is for a week and 100 of whatever the day is for a year. Okay, so I'm belaboring this a little bit because I just want to make sure that you're not thinking too parochially about, you know, this. You know, keep in the spirit of what they're doing here, how they're conveying what's going on. All right, I think that's it there, isn't it? Let's see. They'll mention here in a little bit that there are, you know, when they say fully supplied with all orders of celestial intelligences, remember, most of these intelligences are not revealed in the Revelation. They'll remind you of that. But, you know, always keep that in mind that, by and large, we haven't been revealed, you know, what most of the menagerie is that's roaming about on these giant surface areas. Okay? All right.
The supervisor seraphim, the third order of local universe angels, are assigned... Say again?
Just a little bit louder so that you can hear.
The supervisor seraphim, the third order of local universe angels, are assigned to the service of the constellations. They make their headquarters on the capital spheres and minister extensively to the encircling Marantia training worlds. In Norlashadec, the 70 major spheres, together with the 700 minor satellites, are inhabited by the Univitatia, the permanent citizens of the constellation. All these architectural worlds are fully administered by the various groups of native life, for the greater part unrevealed, but including the efficient Speranga and the beautiful Spornagia, being the midpoint in the Marantia training regime. As you might suspect, the Marantia life of the constellations is both typical and ideal.
All right, so just that last little bit is important. Remember where you are in the spectrum of the Marantia system. You know, you're right in the heart of it. You're not on the spirit substance-like end or the matter substance-like end, you know, where you have on the local universe capital level or the local system level, respectively. Right? You're right there in the heart of the associativity that is that Marantia domain. You know, and I forgot it was literally the next paragraph. You know, they reminded you, for the greater part unrevealed. you know, these beings. But they, remember, we talked about, does anyone remember Sparanga? Who are they? Who gave them existence? Let's put it that way. And remember, who's mom and dad of Sparanga?
My
two
sons and
daughter. Yeah.
Mother and Gabriel.
They're spirit beings. What?
Mother and Gabriel?
Close. Gabriel? Gabriel and the father Melchizedek. Yes, yes. Right?
Amen.
That's the mother-father pair. Remember, we talked about that, how, you know, the Melchizedeks have a lot of mother nature, right? So that they can, you know, and that's, so Sparanga are not created. Sparanga are procreated, right? But the cool thing is, even though they're procreated, they're immortal. And they're, you know, apparently quite spiritual energy system in nature in terms of their bodies. I mean, sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum is this Spranaja, right? And, you know, where do they come from?
They come from Manchmalos.
Yeah, I mean, are they created by the Creator Son, Creator the Mother Spirit? Are they Gabriel and Father Melchizedek? I mean, you know, where do they come from? What are they? Are they beings?
They're animals,
right? They're not beings. They're not persons. They're just animals. I mean, where do animals come from on every world?
The mother.
Who made the animals on this planet? The life carriers, right? I mean, the life carriers are designing animals, right? Including the animal origin will creatures, right? Right, you know, so, you know, and the whole bit of, you know, basically reincarnating them and all those sorts of things. Right, so just, you know, just make sure that, you know, this isn't just words. Now, the Univitatia, you know, which we'll read about later in the paper, they're actually created by the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit. Okay. And, you know, you noticed we had Edentia, we had the T-I-A suffix, you know, I mean, literally just the Edenic place. And Eden means delight in Hebrew, you know, so it's if you want to go even further than the Edenic place, it's the delightful place. But you're going, well, wait a minute, I thought these are beings. Why does it have a T-I-A suffix? Well, that's a fun little thing. I may talk about that when we get to the Univitatia, but if you want to look, you know, look in the etymology, and I explain that. Sometimes they play with those I-A, T-I-A suffixes. They don't use them in just simplistic fashion to indicate a contrast between a person and a thing or a place. Sometimes they use them to indicate some contrast or focus on a particular element of something.
Do you have Sparanga and Fornasia in the etymology too?
No, I haven't figured those out yet. I haven't figured them all out yet. anyway, just want you to remember that, the fact that they say that the greater part are unrevealed, and then the ones they give you are these like really kind of oddball ones that, you know, aren't really beings, they're these fancy animals, you know, and then these procreated ones. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, well, what about all the created ones? It's like, well, most of those are not revealed to you. I mean, you know about supervisor seraphim, and we mentioned those. Remember back when we went through all the orders of the seraphim? You know, that third order, we're now at the level where they function, the constellation level. But by and large, you know, we haven't been revealed all of these, all the, you know, the majority of the beings that are on all these worlds. So, you know, it's just the fact that they do that is kind of just, they're trying to get you to remember that what they've revealed should feel a little sparse. You know, when they can say it's basically unrevealed, but it includes, you know, well, here's a couple of like asterisk ones, you know. I mean, obviously the main core beings are just not revealed at all.
Why too many?
Because it, no, I mean, why don't they reveal things in the fifth epic of Revelation?
Because they don't want to satiate your...
Well, right, there's a number of reasons. I mean, you know, there's that. I mean, they don't want to over-reveal. There's also...
Direct relationship to us, maybe?
Right, I mean, you know, remember they, even if it wouldn't be, quote-unquote, an over-revelation, if it doesn't, if it isn't directly related to the ascension scheme, it's not in here, you know? So a lot of those beings are the other six schemes, right? You know, besides the ascension scheme. You know, and so just thinking like that, it's like, well, okay, so if you don't reveal the other six beings in the other six schemes, you have kind of these oddball asterisk ones that they can mention. I mean, it's just a little reminder. Don't think that everything in the universe is about you and your ascension. I mean, if you just limit it to the ascension scheme, some of the vistas look awfully asymmetric, you know? They don't look very complete, and, you know, so that's just another little humble reminder.
They tell us how many encircling Urantia training worlds there are in the constellation level. How many are there on the system level?
Right, so at the system level... You have the central world, and then you have seven primary satellites, mm-hmm. and then each primary has seven sub-satellites.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
49.
Right. Right.
So are the Spornagia bipeds, or...?
Right, there's all these curious questions. You know, when you think about the things they say about relationship to language and stuff with walking upright. Right. See, they want you to, remember, if you were to meet a Spornagia, you'd think you'd met the most civilized human you'd ever met, and they're not human at all. You know, one of those little reminders, keep in mind. It's just like when you're reading about the evolution of, you know, dawn mammals and et cetera. You know, and you notice some of the things that those pre-human creatures, you know, the kind of emotions they had, the kind of thoughts they had. You go, well, that's human. No. Right. It's, again, I was trying to remind you that a lot of the stuff that we call human is not human. It's just fancy animal. You want to look for something that's genuinely human. Okay? If a dawn mammal can do that, that's a far cry from human, you know, and a lot of what makes a good drama story is the animal stuff. Humans don't make for good Greek dramas. You know, just a little reminder, you know, that philosophers of ancient Greece recognized this, that, you know, this tendency to aggrandize our fancy animal stuff, you know, and exalt it as being, you know, something that humans should be fascinated in and strive for. It's very unfortunate. They knew it 2,600 years ago. We still haven't really recognized this. We still, you know, falsely exalt what's really just dawn mammal, mid-mammal, primate behavior and call it human. You know, to do that is to be human. No, to do that is to be an animal, and not a very fancy one in a lot of cases. Yeah, because Spornagia are still animals, you know, and they'd make primates look like knuckle draggers. Okay. Right, and again, so just, you know, ask yourself that sobering question: If I was standing next to a Spornagia, would I stand out as being more human than that animal? Or would I appear lesser in mind? Yeah.
Are you saying they look human?
Well, let's just assume they did. But forget about what they look like. That's not important. It's how do they think?
Our
Yeah. Could they run circles around you mentally? If so, you've got some work to do. You know, are you smarter than you know your pet? Right? All right. So you know, those are little things between the lines with all these you know these issues. All right. I think that's it there. Let's keep going here. Let's get into the first section here.
Number one, the constellation headquarters. Edentia abounds in fascinating highlands, extensive elevations of physical matter, crowned with Marantia life and overspread with spiritual glory. But there are no rugged mountain ranges such as appear on Urantia. There are tens of thousands of sparkling lakes and thousands upon thousands of interconnecting streams. But there are no great oceans nor torrential rivers. Only the highlands are devoid of these surface streams.
Okay. It's all pretty factual, but notice the little tweaks that they're putting in there. And one of the things they're trying to do there is have you work, you know, just like we were doing with the previous thing with Spornaja, a little more work on exactly what the word spirit means. You know, we use that word in very lowly ways, and they wish we would take it up several notches. You know, so they do things like they say that it's overspread with spiritual glory, but there are no rugged mountain ranges. You're going, I thought Purple Mountain's majesty was the height of spirit. It's like, you know, they're trying to remind you between the lines that, you know, basically what we call spirit is the fancier mental things that we experience. You know, your consciousness is purely in your mind. You can't be conscious of spirit. You know, when we say your spiritual consciousness, it's important to notice the AL suffix on that. You know, it's spirit-like. You know, you're talking about the part of your mental activity that's a little bit more on the unity side than the individuality side. Okay. You know, and you know, one of the spots in the book where they try to drill this home is at the end of the marriage and family life paper, when they point out that one of the main things that we've come to use as the definition for the word spiritual is, and they put it in italics, the potential of pleasure. Okay? Not the actual pleasure, because you know that we you know logically recognize as a feeling and it's mental. Okay, but that subtle transcendent thought of the potential for pleasure. You know, superconsciously we know that spirit is transcendent of mind. So we're looking for something that is a little bit removed from the immediacy of pleasure. But if we put a thought in our head, the potential for pleasure. If we know that something has the potential for pleasure, we'll call that a spiritual thing. You know, we'll call it soul music or something like that. Or, right, we'll use that word spiritual if it has this kind of intangible element of the potential for pleasure in it. You know, and then they point out, you know, right after they remind you of that none of the things, you know, that you basically think are spiritual have one iota of relationship to spirit or do anything relative to your soul. You know, they're very definitive in that statement. They're trying to get, you know, to get us past where the apostles, you know, Jesus tried and tried. He couldn't get the apostles past this point. You know, he couldn't get them to actually have some abstract recognition of the fact of spirit in contrast to matter and feelings about matter. right? Spirit is not a feeling about fancy matter, like the feeling you get, you know, when you see that beautiful vista up on Davidson Mesa here above Boulder, of the Purple Mountains majesty, or, you know, heading down to Colorado Springs, you know. As a matter of fact, if it's Long's Peak or Pike's Peak, you know, neither Purple Mountain majesty is, you know, that you're having a feeling about matter, and that's not spirit. You know, or the feeling you have with a beautiful piece of music, or, okay, it's not to say that there isn't significance there, right? I mean, it might be taking you closer to spirit in your mind than something else does.
Chocolate is not spirit.
Chocolate might take you closer to spirit than broccoli. okay, but
but if you attach to that though, chocolate. That's a whole different story.
I mean, just notice, see what they're doing there between the lines on that. You know that, that they purposely say it's overspread with spiritual glory, but there are no rugged mountain ranges, and they want you to feel your heart drop when you read that. You know, there's no oceans, there's no mountains, there's none of those things that we sing about. There's no beautiful sunset over the ocean. right? I mean, can you fall in love with the potential of an ascension career that doesn't have such a materialistic sense of spirit? You know, that's what they're playing with you a little bit there. Okay, but there are tens of thousands of sparkling lakes and thousands upon thousands of interconnecting streams. So it's not, you know, it definitely has a natural environment to it. But, remember, the only reason you have rugged mountains is because you have an uncontrolled environment. You know, you've got tectonic plates, you know, slamming together and wiping out cities, and you're right. I mean, you don't have that on an architectural world. The headquarters of the Ancients of Days doesn't get destroyed one day in a Force 10 earthquake or something like that. Right? I mean, these architectural worlds are perfectly settled. You know, and all of these streams and lakes, are they natural? No, nothing's natural. The entire planet is an artificial construct. You know, where every stream flows, where every lake is, you know, is all been constructed that way. It's all literally H2O, water. It is literally water, okay? but, you know, we mentioned that, you know, recently too. You know, don't forget, there's no coincidentally, or accidentally, about any of this. It's all very precisely pre-planned and laid out.
What do you mean by artificially constructed?
I mean, an architectural world is built completely. Every automaton is put into place. It's artificial, in the proper sense of the word artificial. It's an art form. You know, that's what the word artificial means. It means it's done as an art form.
No evolution there.
Right, there's nothing evolved into place. Like I said, there's no accidents, there's no... that's a handy coincidence that river happens to be there, you know, so that we can use it for this, you know, right, there's nothing like that. It's all very, you know, and a lot of the water system is, you know, subterranean. You know, they've got tunnels, you know, that they're running water through and whatnot. Okay, you know, because you notice how they're hinting at that right at the end there. Only the highlands are devoid of these surface streams. Does that mean there's no water available in the highlands? No, it just means it's all subterranean. Right? You know, it's piped in. We're going to be able to fall in love with what personality can do to matter, and we'll love it more than what random gravity and stuff does to matter. You know, we're not going to lose anything when we stop calling material things spiritual. We're going to gain something we can't even imagine right now. You know, our current bias that if something is artificial, it means a human did it and it's mucked up. Well, technically, remember what you mean. You mean a dawn mammal did it. And of course it isn't very profound. But if the Spornaja have done it, right? All right, let's keep going here.
The water of Edentia and similar architectural spheres is no different from the water of the evolutionary planets. The water systems of such spheres are both surface and subterranean, and the moisture is in constant circulation. Edentia can be circumnavigated via these various water routes, though the chief channel of transportation is the atmosphere. Spirit beings would naturally travel above the surface of the sphere, while the Marantia and material beings make use of the material and semi-material means to negotiate atmospheric passage.
Okay, right. So it's just like you were wondering there, John C., like they say, the water is just like we know water to be. Water is a very profound substance, and it's profound enough to serve architectural worlds. And you know, and they have there's a whole circulation of the water and everything. So it's a very complex system. You know, not unlike we understand about the circulation of water through our ecosystem. Okay, and then they throw in, the fascinating thing about all of these water channels that you can actually circumnavigate the globe if you wanted to in the canals, and you can't help but think about, you know, those when they were looking through poor telescopes at Mars, you know, and thinking they were seeing all the canals that the civilization on Mars had built and how they interconnected and you know, could circumnavigate Mars in the canals, you know. So here it is. You know, that actually is on high, but not on Mars. So that's kind of a fun little twist, if you know that history. Percival Lowell would be pleased to know that he wasn't totally off. they say that's, you know, basically though they use the atmosphere to get about. You know, and you know, they point out that even if that wasn't the chief channel, spirit beings would naturally do that. Everyone else, you know, is using contrivances of some sort. I mean, there's craft and other things that, you know, are literally hauling these Marantia and material bodies about on the planet. They have to get into some sort of a transport device of some sort to go from point A to point B. They can't just think their way from point A to point B. Now, remember, we talked about this a little bit, that with beings like seraphim, let's just take seraphim, you know, like they mentioned the supervisor seraphim. So how do they get about? Remember how we talked about this when we were talking about going from one planet to another and needing transport seraphim? That's one issue. If you're trying to go between two systems of motion where you're out there in interplanetary space, you need a being that's specially constructed that can lock on to the energy lanes and whatnot. And, you know, if you're just a run-of-the-mill supervisor seraphim, you can't do that. You know, you've got to get into a transport seraphim and ride it from point A to point B between planets. But within a world's domain, you know, like they're obviously indicating here, I mean, they don't have to get a transport seraphim to go from New York to London, say, you know, a seraphim on this planet. They can relate to the system of motion more in a fluid sort of a way, and they can ride that motion. Whereas if you're a Marantia, a material being, like they're saying, I mean, you're sort of locked in. I mean, why do we think it's a universe of matter instead of a universe of motion, like we were talking about in the previous paper? Because we don't have any direct consciousness of the motion. We aren't like it in any immediate way. You know, so the only thing we can imagine doing is plopping ourselves in some contrivance and carting our body across space. Okay? But if we actually were aware of, you know, this domain we're in a dynamic way, like an angel is, you know, and we were more like that, more innately dynamic, you know, we would just, you know, synchronize with that, and we would go with the flow in that environment, you know, just the way a sailboat goes with the flow of the wind. You know, they just are going to ride the motion, you know, within the motion system. But if you get out of that motion system between planets, there's no wind for the sailboat sails, you know, to tack on. Okay, and so you have to have a, you know, a being that can navigate, you know, through the Sargasso Sea, you know, region between the planets. Okay? So that's what's going on here. So, I mean, obviously we don't know the details, the physics, but in some way they're just, you know, they're less, they're less static-like, you know, more motion-like, and more can just get in with the motion, just like the sail can become one with the breeze. And ride it. And I mean, and who knows what their speed is. I mean, in this context, I don't know. But it's probably pretty fast. The reason it's probably pretty fast is just because the motion we're talking about, you know, is fast. I mean, these motions, like, you know, the foundation is the speed of light, right? So, okay. So you would assume that this breeze, you know, that they're putting a sail into, in some way, you know, is a very stiff breeze, you know, and they'll carry him from point A to point B quite quickly. You know, in a similar idea is when we toy with the idea that if we could develop an electromagnetic system of some sort that could produce artificial gravity, you know, we recognize that we could sail within the gravitational environment here, as it were. Right? See, that's what they're doing, only not in that, you know, that kind of static Newtonian gravity sense, but in the real sense of the motion that is gravity. Right? So they're just, you know, they're just doing that. They're modifying their relationship to it, like you modify a sail's relationship to the direction of the wind and going where they want to go. All right. Let's see, did we get everything there? I think we did. Yeah, let's keep going here.
Edentia and its associated worlds have a true atmosphere. The usual three gas mixture, which is characteristic of such architectural creations and which embodies the two elements of Urantian atmosphere plus that Marantia gas suitable for the respiration of Marantia creatures. But while this atmosphere is both material and Marantial, there are no storms or hurricanes. Neither is there summer nor winter. This absence of atmospheric disturbances and of seasonal variation makes it possible to embellish all outdoors on these especially created worlds.
Well, that's a positive. So yeah, you spent all that time on your garden, okay, and the flood or the hailstorm or whatever is not going to take it out. I mean, that's nice to know that finally we'll be liberated of that annoying thing where the world just could care less how much time you just spent, you know, on trimming your lawn. The tornado just comes through, rips up the lawn, tears out the trees, and blows your house down. So all of that goes away. Thank God. And then we've mentioned this frequently because this is a very important thing. You know, that little reminder there between the lines. There's nothing coincidental about what two primary gases are in this atmosphere in front of us here, in this room. You know, that it's primarily nitrogen, followed by oxygen. There's nothing natural about nitrogen and oxygen being in the atmosphere of any planet. If you find a planet somewhere in the universe that has nitrogen and oxygen in the atmosphere, that's there artificially. That's because that world was terraformed. If it's a natural world, it has nothing but carbon dioxide. Venus and Mars are natural. All they have is carbon dioxide. The air we're breathing is artificial. Right? There's nothing natural about the nitrogen and oxygen here. That's a pattern that's been brought down artificially from on high. Architectural worlds have nitrogen and oxygen. And so when they terraform a world, begin to make it an artificial domain, it has nitrogen and oxygen. Yeah. So just, you know, think about how that modifies the idea of how, quote unquote, natural our environment is. There's nothing natural about an inhabited world. A natural world can't be inhabited.
What about non-breathers?
Well, that even more so. You know, yes, they don't have an atmosphere or things like that, but, you know, one day those non-breathers, evolve to a greater consciousness and they go, I wonder who built these vast subterranean complexes that we live in. Right, because they can't live on the surface, right? I mean, the surface is, you know, until they can build those anti-gravity and whatnot installations on the surface. And stuff. You know, when they're primitives, they're living in a completely artificial environment, right?
I was always wondering about
that. Right? I mean, there's nothing natural about an inhabited world. The whole point is the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. The natural world is death to life. You know, to make this an inhabited world, first they have to block out most of the harsh environment in the constellation. It would just eviscerate us instantly if they didn't create this cocoon that we live in. You know, and then, you know, all the way down to the details. Every molecule of oxygen and nitrogen in this atmosphere is here artificially. Right?
So if they find water on a world, there's got to be oxygen, right?
I mean, obviously, you know, there'll be, you know, little tiny bits maybe of nitrogen or oxygen that are natural, but you know, not significant amounts. And the water is the water is here pretty naturally, you might say. I mean, they don't have to make the water that's on this planet. You know, a lot of the water of this planet has never seen the light of day. You know, it's still locked down in the interior of the Earth, even. Let's see, where were we? There was something else. Oh, yeah. Right, and then what's the third gas? I mean, you know, you notice they don't literally tell you. They want you to logically think through it. Okay, so there's a Marantia gas suitable for the respiration of Marantia creatures. Marantia substance is material substance that's been modified by adding some spirit energy to it. Right, it's Marantia oxygen, obviously. You know, and just that little tidbit of, you know, when you just because you have a Marantia body doesn't mean you're not going to still be breathing. And you're going to be breathing in a very parallel way. You're going to be breathing oxygen still, not material oxygen, but Marantia oxygen. You know, so you go, huh? Well, you know, the primitives when they focus so much on the breath, you know, like say the word spirit, you know, just literally means breath. They aren't too far off. I mean, even in heaven, quote unquote, I'm still going to be breathing for a long time. I mean, I guess when I finally am a first stage spirit and leave the local universe, I guess I don't need to respirate oxygen molecules anymore. But all the way on to, I'm still going to need oxygen atmosphere on Salvington so I don't suffocate.
Right? Chris, it doesn't make sense because we don't have a circulatory system.
You have all kinds of things, obviously, with a Marantia body. Remember, the most amazing thing they tell you is this water we're talking about. I'm going to drink material water with my, you know, and somehow consume that in my Marantia body. Right, completely, right? Nothing comes out. I pour in a whole glass of H2O, and I incorporate that into my Marantia body. I mean, so how material is my Marantia body? Very much material. I mean, I literally put hydrogen and oxygen molecules into it in some way. You know, and don't ask me to explain that. That's very mysterious stuff. I mean, how is it that, you know, no one can see my soul? You know, and if there's a Marantia being standing in front of me, I could pass my hand through him. So how do I picture him drinking a glass of water and having it not just fall on the floor? All right, see, there's some mysteries here they don't explain. You know, I mean, the other little thing like that is, you know, those Marantia beings have to use semi-material means of transport. Right? There's craft, you know, or some sort of a conveyance of some sort, tramways or something, right? there's something. So, you know, it all isn't just, you know, magic floating, you know, sort of thing. All right, let's see here. Let's keep going.
Back to what you were saying.
I got one more thing.
Well, you know, remember when Jesus appeared after in a quasi-marantial form,
right?
And he had, I'm not so sure how much he ate and drank along when he had that meal with them along the shore there.
Right.
But you know, that may be an explanation in a way of the. Because you think about it, you know, the concept of being, how does a Marantia being that you pass, you're going to really drink a glass of water.
Right. Or that, you know, the asterisk, of course, with, you know, Jesus' quote-unquote Marantia appearances, they weren't just purely Marantia appearances, you know. The master physical controllers were adding a material energy body to him, you know. So, right, you know, but, yeah, but still, it's, yeah. You know, it is kind of interesting thinking, okay, so that kind of, you know, that sort of holographic, quote-unquote, you know, holodeck sort of body that the master physical controllers are giving Jesus, you know, so it picks up a glass of water. That material, quote unquote, body obviously could have lips. It could, you could put a cup up to, and you know, you could pour water down a throat. But you know, if he did that, did his Marantia body actually take up that water and use it? See, that's an interesting thing to wonder about. I mean, there's all these mysterious things that I don't understand. That's like I said, I mean, if I could ask a secondary midwifery one question, it would be, you know, explain to me in exactly what way are you close to me? Because see, it's all this same question. You know, how is it that water is close enough to Marantia substance that, you know, it can incorporate it into it? You know, how is it that they're close enough to Marantia substance that they can have Marantia mind seated on them?
Or breathe.
You know, and all these, you know, how is all this stuff similar? How is material energy similar to Marantia energy, similar to spirit energy? How does this work? Yeah. All right, let's keep going.
The Adinsha Highlands are magnificent physical features, and their beauty is enhanced by the endless profusion of life which abounds throughout their length and breadth. Excepting a few rather isolated structures, these highlands contain no work of creature hands. Material and marantial ornamentations are limited to the dwelling areas. The lesser elevations are the sites of special residences and are beautifully embellished with both biologic and Marantia art.
Yes, you know, so there's kind of just, you know, you get the sense of when they say no work of creature hands, like, you know, don't overplay that. I mean, those highlands wouldn't be there except for creature hands. I mean, the master physical controllers built those highlands, right? But, you know, they just mean there aren't, you know, log cabins and whatnot, okay? You know, or fancy outdoor sculptures or something. All right.
Situated on the summit of the seventh highland range are the resurrection halls of Edentia, wherein awaken the ascending mortals of the secondary modified order of ascension. These chambers of creature reassembly are under the supervision of the Melchizedeks. The first of the receiving spheres of Edentia, like the planet Melchizedek near Salvington, also has special resurrection halls wherein the mortals of the modified orders of ascension are reassembled.
Just because we haven't gotten to that yet, I believe one time I had to refer you forward to that. You know, we'll finally get to that. What is that? Paper 49, I think that is. At the end of paper 49, when they'll talk about the mortals of the secondary modified orders of ascension, and the deal is there, if your mortal world life is advanced enough, you skip over at least the mansion worlds. And so there's three different notches. You can skip directly to your local system headquarters, which is obviously not relevant to what we're talking about here, but there's two higher notches of the secondary modified order, like they're calling there. You can jump all the way to the beginning of the work through the satellites and sub-satellites at the constellation level. So you start at world that's like the planet Melchizedek, like they're saying. Or you can even skip over all of that, jump all the way to your, you know, like in our case, jump all the way to Edentia and start your ascension career there. You know, remember, of course, you got to do the back, you know, work. But in terms of your ascension career, you skip over having to ascend up through all of those intervening levels. You just go back there and work and teach in those previous levels. Yeah. So there has to be resurrection halls on the constellation level because there's humans that are jumping all the way there. All right. You got something?
And a resurrection hall is a very different thing than just building you a new Marantia body you can translate.
Yeah, I remember there are these quote-unquote halls because there's obviously some sort of an environment that they have to create within a structure that you are put together in, you know, and it's very significant. I mean, remember on the lower level, you've got, you know, Red Man is resurrected in this hall, you know, Indigo Man is resurrected in this hall, you know, and you can't mix them up because whatever environment is in that building, you know, would mess up the resurrecting of a Red Man if it's the Indigo Man Hall. So even though you're not necessarily doing that here, if you're this advanced, it's a blended race and all this sort of stuff, you know, you're way along in the evolution of the world. But still, I mean, there's some complex physics to this resurrection thing where it's not just you, the part. You have to be constructed in some sort of environment, and an environment that can't be outside of that room because it would mess up the living spaces. I mean, it's like an operating room of some sort that has energies that need to be contained within that building. And
you don't need that for translating from one Marantia body to the next.
Oh, right, yeah, well, remember with the early ones, you actually do need those resurrection halls because they're literally, you know, killing your old body, throwing it away, and making you a whole new body. You know, you die in the, you know, between those early man, you know, those early mansion worlds. But you know, all those other ones, you're rekeyed. You know, so you know, you don't need to be, you don't have to have a whole new body formed in this environment. You know, you've got it, and they just get the crescent wrenches out and twist a few, dials and whatnot, and you know, and reset you. But,
the diversity of that resurrection and need, the necessity of those
and separateness and all that. Yeah,
it just reminds me, or opens a question of the diversity of, that's needed for the supreme.
Yeah, I mean, diversity is so definitive, you literally can't be resurrected in the same hall as the other person, because there would, you'd short-circuit that potential of the supreme needs to actualize. You've got to be very separate, you know, and kept very separate for a long time.
Though they say we're kind of so blended now.
Right.
We actually have our own hall.
Right, you have the blended halls, that's what I was saying. I mean, up here, you obviously are dealing with blended halls by the time you get... Yeah, and right, and even now, right, yeah.
Material, spiritual, Marantia, Chris, they are similar, these various energies, for this reason, that they are unified? Could you explain more?
Well, I mean, the only thing that we can say just philosophically, we know they're related because fundamentally, matter, mind, and spirit are a triunity. But in and of themselves, they're very different. I mean, matter is absolutely separate from mind, which is absolutely separate from spirit, because there's an absolute of matter, the absolute mind, and the absolute spirit. They're absolutely three separate energies. But Mother Deity coordinates them together. You know, so, I mean, obviously, you know, when I say that, I mean, potentially they can be, you know, you can combine spirit and physical energy and make Marantia substance in some sort of weave. But see, the physics of that involves Mother Deity. You know, and so this question about exactly how is like a secondary midway really close to me energetically, it's a very profound question. It involves the nature of our relationship to the Paradise Trinity and Mother Deity. You know, so see, even if I could ask the question, I'm sure they couldn't say anything that I could, you know, I could track. But you know, if somehow I could understand how they are associable, so how they can be close.
They could write it down.
You know, it. I mean, it's a very huge question. I mean, if you understood that at all, you would really have deep insight into the nature of reality. All right, let's keep going here.
The Melchizedeks also maintain two special colleges on Edentia. One, the Emergency School, is devoted to the study of problems growing out of the Satania Rebellion. The other, the Bestowal School, is dedicated to the mastery of the new problems arising out of the fact that Michael made the final bestowal on one of the worlds of Norlashadek. This later college was established almost 4,000 years ago.
It's actually supposed to be 40.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, that's a typo.
Okay, immediately after the announcement by Michael that Urantia had been selected as the world for his final bestowal.
Yeah, now that's an actual typo in the first printing that should be changed to 40, you know, because they tell you in other places, you know, when he made that announcement. That's just a typo. But, you know, this is why Narlasha has the deck on the end. This is what's special about this constellation. You know, it has these two special schools in it. Okay? And so they're reminding you of that by putting the deck suffix on it. It's not just the Northern Law Place. It's the Northern Law Place with Melchizedek identification. Okay? It's got these two special colleges, these two special schools. You know, and, you know, Michael selecting, you know, our planet is, like they're saying there, nothing but problems. I mean, it throws a giant rock in the whole plan. It's like, okay, throw out all your plans. We got to start all over again. You know, everything's got to be changed. Right. Yeah. Things that weren't anticipated, you know. Right. All kinds of problems to be solved. Yeah. You know, problems doesn't have to be a negative word, right?
The sea of glass, the receiving area of Adentia, is near the administrative center and is encircled by the headquarters amphitheater. Surrounding this area are the governing centers for the 70 divisions of Constellation Affairs. One half of Adentia is divided into 70 triangular sections, whose boundaries converge at the headquarters buildings of their respective sectors. The remainder of this sphere is one vast national park, the Gardens of God.
Natural park, not national park. Oh. Natural park, the Gardens of... All right, so there's, you know, there's an appropriate to naturalness, you know, see, but again, it's, you know, it's artificially natural. Okay, and just quickly, I mean, you know, so we'll discover later in the paper that the hemisphere that is not the Gardens is the southern hemisphere. It's the whole northern hemisphere that's the Garden. Okay, and the southern hemisphere, you know, is like orange wedges, right? Just going down like bands of longitude. Is broken up into 70 wedges, you know, going from the equator down to the South Pole, you know, and down there around the South Pole, and each one of those is a sector capital, you know, and then down, you know, immediately the polar region, you've got the Sea of Glass, and you've got where the actual full headquarters is for the Most Highs. Yeah, so that's what they're describing there.
During your periodic visits to Adentia, though the entire planet is open to your inspection, most of your time will be spent in that administrative triangle whose number corresponds to that of your current residential world. You will always be welcome as an observer in the legislative assemblies.
Right, so you remember how we just have the 70 bodies for the 70 primary satellites, see how it all matches up. You have these 70 sectors. So if you're on the 12th primary world and its sub-satellites, soon you go to Adentia, you go to that 12th sector, you know, primarily.
Do the satellites orbit in synchrony with the sector?
We don't know how this works with, exactly how, you know, I mean, do they have the 70 worlds, you know, locked to the rotation of the central world, or I don't know. I don't know what kind of physics is possible in such an artificial, setting. I mean, obviously, it isn't very natural for 70 worlds to form in a string of pearls and orbit an object, right? So, this is all very artificially, constructed and maintained, so I don't know.
You have to in Seraphim to go to these places.
Right? Yeah, and you'd have to in Seraphim to go from one world to another, yeah. Yeah, because you're going out of an immediate motion environment. So yeah, you've got to in Seraphim. To even go to a sub-satellite, you're going from world to world.
Just
keep them
busy.
Yep, so you'll be taking lots and lots of Transport Seraphim rides. Nothing. Frequent flyer, just unbelievably frequent flyer miles. It'll be so exciting when you're finally a finaliter and you don't have to take a Transport Seraphim anymore. You know.
Is it just a single rider?
Yeah, and just all single.
It's always by yourself.
Always by yourself. And, yeah.
Are you conscious? Can you watch the stars?
No, remember they. Yeah.
You want a window seat, right?
You're sleeping, quote unquote. You're consciously unconscious, as they say.
Chris, is it way less troublesome than we experience? Like, it's so hard for...
You don't have to take off your shoes. Yeah. You don't have to go through a metal detector.
your ears aren't popping.
I mean, say it's taxing to us, everything we do on our world. so I imagine it's not so taxing.
I'm sure it's all the less taxing the higher you go up. You
That's
know.
What I mean.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be more and more fluid. You know, the less a blob of matter you are, you know, that's why it's taxing for us. You know, we got to lug this thing around. It's just, we're not very motion-like, you know. And so when we want to do motion things, it's kind of antithetical to the blob of protoplasm. Yeah.
The Mirantia area assigned to ascending mortals resident on Edentia is located in the mid-zone of the 35 triangle adjoining the headquarters of the Finaliters, the 35th triangle of the Finaliters, situated in the 36th triangle. The general headquarters of the Univitatia occupies an enormous area in the mid-region of the 34th triangle, immediately adjoining the residential reservation of the Mirantia citizens. From these arrangements, it may be seen that provision is made for the accommodation of at least 70 major divisions of celestial life, and also that each of these 70 triangular areas is correlated with some one of the 70 major spheres of Mirantia training.
Right, so just there, you know, to have one primary one, you got to have 70 different flavors. Yeah, like they're saying, and basically they can't tell us anything about that because they haven't revealed most of those beings. So. Right, right, yeah. So you can notice there, you know, they're giving you all these interesting little things that one day I'm sure humans will figure out the patterns that are being spoken of. I mean, it's just like up here when they said, situated on the summit of the 7th Highland Range. Okay, there's some clue there that it's the 7th Highland Range. And, you know, what that clue is, I don't know. Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can remember if you go back and the groups of worlds around Salvington, you know, that's one of the things they're wanting you to think about is parallels, you know, and you'll see there's some parallels. We don't want to go into that right here, but you know, but yeah, but just noticing that you're kind of on the far side, you know, of the set, you know, when you're in the Finaliter Ascender region. Yeah.
The Edentia Sea of Glass is one enormous circular crystal about 100 miles in circumference and about 30 miles in depth. This magnificent crystal serves as the receiving field for all transport seraphim and other beings arriving from points outside the sphere, such as a sea of glass greatly facilitates the landing of transport seraphim.
Yeah, just quickly there, you remember, notice how back there they said the Sea of Glass, the receiving area of Edentia, is near the administrative center, you know, back a few paragraphs there. I mean, they never tell you explicitly. You know, if I'm supposed to think of the Sea of Glass as being literally at the axis, you know, the pole, the rotational axis, or is the administrative headquarters right directly at the pole? Or, I mean, you know, when they say that the receiving area is near the administrative center, it almost makes it sound like it's you know, away from the pole rather than, I don't know. I mean, they never give you these little details precisely, but in the immediate polar area is all these things in some way or another.
30 miles deep.
Okay, and then remember, you know, this is all times seven.
Yeah,
this is all times seven. So, you know, it's 700 miles by 210 miles. Right, and it's a single crystal. Yeah.
I wonder why it's so deep. Because that's how it works?
Well, yeah, because it's obviously a machine of some sort that requires real, you know, a large amount of what would be a word, you know, sort of inertia or capacity, you know, or I mean, you know, whatever. It's being tuned into energies and of great, you know, magnitude. So, you know, whatever the physics of it is, you know, we obviously can't understand. But
receiving field.
Right, and
which is does that mean a field of energy or a field like a
football player? Well, yeah, and it's, you know, such a sea of glass greatly facilitates the landing of transport seraphim. Why? Who knows? they don't explain that. You know, remember the way this works. You know, that pole that has the sea of glass not only receives transports but communications, and then the opposite pole transmits communications. And
I mean, it reminds me of how the field they draw around magnets. So mm-hmm. they have little arrows going in one end.
Right. I mean, all we can do is just kind of guess at analogies here. But and everyone knows, you know. No one on high is calling them a sea of glass, right? I mean, why is it called a sea of glass? Because that's how the Apostle John described it, you know, in the book of Revelation, right? When he had that vision. I think that was of the Gerizim sea of glass, if I remember correctly. Right, so you know, they just adopted that term and call it that. It isn't literally a sea of glass. I mean, you know, it's actually a crystal. But, you know, what else could poor old fisherman John, you know, understand? All right.
A crystal field on this order is found on almost all architectural worlds, and it serves many purposes aside from its decorative value, being utilized for portraying super-universe reflectivity to assembled groups, and as a factor in the energy transformation technique for modifying the currents of space and for adapting other incoming physical energy streams.
Right, see, like we were just saying, mm-hmm. see, obviously they're plugging into big things, so it's got to be quite massive. Just one little kind of tidbit there. A crystal field on this order is found on almost all architectural worlds. A little trivia question. Can someone tell me an architectural world that you know about that doesn't have a sea of glass? Hint, it's the first one you're going to. Very first mansion world doesn't have a sea of glass. The second one and subsequent ones do. But the first mansion world doesn't have a sea of glass.
All the transport seraphim just
kind of slam into the surface, yeah. And yeah, tuck and roll, boys.
Incoming.
So yeah, again, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's like, you know, then they tell you that's like, well, so how does that work? What am I supposed to, you know,
Did you use old-fashioned air traffic control?
Yeah, I mean, are you supposed to make jokes about it or what? You know, I mean, they just leave you with these mysterious statements like that. But yeah, it doesn't. You know, if you remember, and you go to the mansion rolls, and they're talking about the second one. They say, you know, here's your, you know, where you'll find your first sea of glass. So that's an example of one that doesn't have one, but they don't explain why. I mean, obviously, you know, when transport seraphim land here, you know, they don't have a sea of glass to land on, you know, and they describe them floating gently down to the surface, you know, and things like this. So, you know, they're not tucking and rolling and, you know, crashing and burning, you know, when they land on this planet. Yeah, but, you know, but they do say it greatly facilitates the landing. So, I don't know. What does that mean? I mean, is it more of an instrument landing when there's a sea of glass, you know, and it just sort of lands itself, but they've got to be more consciously involved in the landing when there isn't? I don't know.
You've got to have pilot skills to land in this one.
You can just speculate. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that was fun.
Leave it to a controller.
Well, I mean, you know, think about all the incoming into the first mansion world. All right, so, they just leave that for speculation. All right, so we'll get into, you know, that finishes with kind of the basic setting, and then, well, you can see we start to get into a little bit more of the details about what's going on there, why it's the Northern Law, place and things like that. When we get into it next time here. So, all right, let's take a moment here.